But like I found that like if you just go five blocks in any direction, you tend to lose the crowds. And when you lose the crowds of tourists, you lose the tourist prices.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today, nomadic Matt Kepnes comes back on the show to talk about long-term travel. His new book out this week is How to Travel the World on $75 a Day. And we spend this episode talking about ways to save money while planning an extended global journey. We kick things off by talking about how much of Matt's travel style has changed in the nearly two decades since he first started vagabonding. Let's listen in. How much of a backpacker are you still? Because you've been doing this for a long time now, and I've been doing it for even longer. And I know that when you passed through Paris, I'm pretty sure you stayed at a hostel. Like you still have a lot of those core ethos things. So what percentage of the backpacker still dictates the way Matt Kepnes travels versus the way he traveled almost 20 years ago?
I would say it's... the backpacker Matt is still there. Modern day Matt loves flying in comfort. You know, I'm really into the points and miles thing. So I do fly a lot of business class flights. I stay in hotels more. But it really, like, I still look for like those deals. Like, sure. Like, I always tell people you can get a fancy steak anywhere in the world, right? So like, It doesn't matter. You got money to spend, you can get top level food. But I really want those hole in the wall places, those markets. I would prefer to take public transportation over an Uber or a taxi. I still go for free walking tours, and once in a while, if I'm traveling a bit longer and by myself, I will probably stay in a hostel, like you said. You know, like, if I'm just in the city for like 1 or 2 days and I know like I have a packed schedule because I'm either writing an article or I'm meeting friends, yeah, that's fine. But if I'm like in a new city for like 4 days by myself, I'll probably go to a hostel just to meet other people.
But let's rewind a little bit and just sort of talk about the framework for how you would approach travel. And oftentimes this framework predates the trip. It's about dreaming the possibilities of a world journey, deciding where you want to go and what you're going to do when you get there. But I think one big hurdle before the trip begins, somebody, I think Levinson Wood, said that the hardest part of a big journey is getting to the starting line. And I tend to agree. How do you overcome those fears that might tempt you to not even take the trip to begin with?
I think there's a Dutch proverb that is not really a Dutch proverb, but online it is said as a Dutch proverb that the hardest part of any journey is stepping out the door. For a lot of people, blowing up their life and putting on a backpack and going away for 6 months, a year, is nerve-wracking. You know, it's scary. I think this is less true today than it was when you and I did this, thanks to the rise of social media and blogs, and digital nomadism has really just kind of shown people that, like, okay, this is possible and like you can do it. And so I think, especially among younger people, there's less fear of going. A lot of it is just sort of like, how do I afford it? And, you know, am I going to make friends? Like, that's always a big question I get. Like, am I going to be safe? Is it going to, will I be alone? And I always tell people that, one, 50 years from now, you'll regret not taking the trip anyway. But two, millions of people have done this before you. Millions and millions and hundreds of millions probably have done this before you. Millions of people are doing it right now, and millions of people will do it later. And all of them pretty much end up fine, right? Like, outside of like the outlier drug, you know, somebody gets caught with drugs in the country, people go backpacking and they come home. and they have nothing but great stories to share. And so, like, don't think you're, you know, Neil Armstrong going to the moon for the first time, right? Or you're that Viking crossing the Atlantic into the unknown, you know, for the first time. Like, people have done this. And the other thing I always tell people is you can always come home. Like, if you don't like it, like, just come home. You know, travel is about pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone and testing your limits. And maybe, and learning about yourself. And maybe the thing you learn about yourself is you don't like to travel.
Yeah, if you don't like travel, you don't have to travel. It's not like only good people travel. And if you don't travel, you're a bad person. And so I think if it's something that you're curious about, just try it, you know, just try it for a few weeks and then see if it's something that you want to stretch into a few months.
Yeah. And you can always start someplace quote unquote easy, right? Like, you know, if your native language is English, go to an English speaking country, right? It will just be a little less work.
You know, well, you went to Australia then, right? Was it for that reason?
No, I just wanted to go because I like Bryson's book, but I was supposed to go with my friend Joe, and then Joe backed out. But I already taken the time off work and I didn't want to go to Australia by myself. And so I just ended up on like a G Adventures tour to Costa Rica, and that sparked everything. But I speak a little Spanish, so I wasn't too stressed about it. You know, so I always tell people that go somewhere that's like, you won't feel so intimidated. You know, you don't have to, like, your first trip doesn't have to be to, you know, rural Cambodia or, you know, Ghana, right? Like, it can be to maybe just you take another trip to a different part of your own country.
Yeah, no, that's where I started. My first vagabonding trip was eight months in North America, and I just learned so much. And it was probably more expensive than an equivalent trip in the Middle East or Southeast Asia. But I think part of traveling close to home was sort of getting over those basic fears of travel and just realizing that it was easier and cheaper and simpler than I thought it would be. I know that money is a big inhibiting factor. And so what kind of advice do you give people before the trip even begins on how to make money or save money for a journey that goes beyond the normal 2-week vacation?
Yeah, well, the first thing I tell people to do is look at your budget, right? Track your spending. Most people don't keep a tight eye on their spending. But if you're going away for 3, 6, 9, 12 months, every penny counts. And so you want as many pennies as you can before you go. And the best way to do that is to know what you spend money on. You know, so track your budget for a couple of weeks and see where the money goes. And then you can really start thinking about cutting things down. You might spend a lot more on food delivery than you think about it, or Ubers, or you know, maybe you have a book buying habit that you can get a library card for, or you know, you see a lot of movies or whatever it is. You know, I think once you do that, you can start removing the low-hanging fruit, you know, public transportation, cooking more. Maybe you don't get a Starbucks every day. And then I like to think of it as a game, right? You know, start with like a small goal. I'm just going to save $5 a day. And then, you know, once you start doing that and you start saving $6 a day, $10 a day, it becomes this game where you're like, how much more can I cut? And it also makes it a lot easier for you to reach your goal because you start seeing these small wins, and every win begets another win. You know, if you start saying yes, like, oh, yes, I can do that, and it happens, then you take another step forward. Where I think a lot of people just like say, no, I can't afford to travel, but without really thinking about like how much does it cost and could I actually save that much money?
I like the idea of thinking of it as a game because then it sort of puts you into the imaginative world of travel, which is all about problem solving. And so if you can just sort of see those small savings, that skipping Starbucks this day and, you know, maybe doing transportation instead of an Uber, public transportation instead of an Uber, then that game just, it puts you into the travel mindset. And I think you know, you can't, when you're traveling, you're almost forced to live a simpler life. And if you can live a simpler life before the travel begins, not only does it save you money, but it puts you into that mm-hmm. travel mindset. So that trip in mind, let's just look at ways to save money once we're on the road. We've talked a little bit about hosteling. Besides hostels, what are ways to save money, you know, beyond just avoiding the expensive hotels?
Yeah. Well, one of the things you could do if you want to stay in the hotels is really collect points. You know, I am a firm believer in points and miles. As long as you can pay your credit card balance off each month, you're winning. I mean, you're spending the money anyway, right? And so points can go a long way in cushioning the expense of accommodation because, like, you have to have a place to stay every night, right? And so I use points a lot to offset accommodation costs. But another thing you can do is consider something like a home exchange, where, you know, if you aren't giving up your place, you can go to, say, Paris and stay in someone else's place while they stay in your place. And, you know, you can string this along for a while. If you are giving up your place to go traveling, consider something like trusted house sitters, which, you know, allows you to watch people's homes while they're away. Or maybe, you know, it might be a vacation home, so they're gone for the season. Or maybe they're just gone on a regular trip. And so it gives you a place to stay for 2 weeks or more. So if you're really traveling slow, this is a great option. And then there's a lot of couchsurfing-esque websites these days. Couchsurfing was this major app that allowed people to stay with locals for free. It was a cultural exchange thing. But ever since they paywalled the entire site, usage of it has really gone down. And a lot of other services have come up. And so you can use something like Be Welcome. There's one for women simply called Travel Ladies. And what's really happened, which just surprises me, because I thought Facebook was only for, you know, really old people these days. But a lot of young people and a lot of people in general use Facebook groups as a way to meet other travelers and meet locals. And so you have a lot of groups out there that work like Couchsurfing did. So that's another option to really cut your costs.
Do you go by destination on those Facebook groups? You join the club for Colombia, or is it more around themes?
They run the gamut. You know, there's ones just for women travelers. There's ones just to find travel like partners, like you want to just go travel. And then there's like backpacking Europe, backpacking Australia, Colombia expats. Yeah, like there's just, you type it in, you'll find lots of groups around themes or destinations.
Let's move on to saving money on food and drink. You mentioned eatwith.com, which I'd never heard of before. So what are some general tips for saving money on food and drink? And then what are some of these innovative sort of host sharing type strategies that you talk about in your book?
Yeah, you know, we all get to eat, but I say eat like you live. You know, you don't go out to eat every night. You cook. So cook some meals. If you don't have a kitchen, go buy some pre-made meals. You know, you don't have to eat at a restaurant all the time. One thing I like about hostels, most of them have free breakfast, which is a great way to fill up for free and then grab some snacks for later. The quintessential, like, you know, they have bread and meats and cheeses and you make a couple of sandwiches and that's your lunch. But, you know, I love going to supermarkets and local farmers markets and just buying stuff for a picnic or to make a salad or a sandwich. And that's that. You know, oftentimes I like staying at a hostel because they'll have a kitchen, but there's different service apartments and stuff where you can get a kitchen too. So just cooking some of your meals will automatically lower your costs. But then looking for like good, more local restaurants that are maybe inexpensive, and the rise of like local food bloggers has really created like a ton of content and resources where you can just kind of look like cheap Thai restaurants and look at these blogs and look at these TikTokers and to get like information about like where to eat, you know. Back in the day, like you just kind of had to wander around and hope it was good. Nowadays, you can just find that information online from locals that live there. But I would say the biggest thing is just to, you know, going back to what we said in the beginning, it's like you can get steak anywhere, right? Like you can get like high-end French food wherever you live. You know, so try to avoid that and look for just like those sort of hole-in-the-wall spots.
Tell me about the 5-block rule. What does that mean?
That's my rule. Oh, just to go back before that is like also ask like the staff of the hotel or the hostel you're staying at where they eat, right? Because like if you ask like where do you eat, they're going to tell you where they go, and chances are it's not going to be these overpriced places. You know, I doubt the person that working in a hostel is eating at only Michelin star restaurants. But the 5-block rule is my sort of de facto rule that there's this invisible line around like major tourist areas or destinations, you know, like the Louvre or Big Ben or, you know, Times Square. And after 5 blocks, people just start like the tourist crowds go away. It seems too far from the main action. And then you start to get the real local places, right? You know, the places where the menu is only in the native language, or maybe it's also in, they might have a small English menu. The prices reflect locals. And so it's just sort of like, I found that like, if you just go five blocks in any direction, you tend to lose the crowds. And when you lose the crowds of tourists, you lose the tourist prices.
Tell me about like eatwith.com. You mentioned a few websites that I guess they're like meal sharing or host meal websites. I don't know much about those. What can you tell us about those?
Yeah, picture those sites like couch surfing or ride sharing, but for food. You know, you, let's say Rolf, like you're an expert in Thai food, or you just like cooking Thai food, or just like cooking in general. And so you host a dinner on the site and strangers come and to your place and you cook for us. You know, and you set the whatever price you want. They used to be a better bargain. Nowadays, they're not as good of a bargain as like eating out. I think people have gotten a little too spendy with them. But even though they're not the always, like you still find some good deals there, but even though they might not always be cheaper than a restaurant, it's definitely a fun experience. You know, I've done this a few times. One time I was in Lyon, and this kid just cooked a burger, which was actually a really good burger. He just did it because he wanted to meet people. And he turned out to be a jazz musician, and he was happened to be playing a show that night because we went over for lunch. And so he took us to this jazz club that was on a boat on this river in Lyon. I never would have found this. I think me and my friend were the only non-French people there. Like, it was a really cool experience. But never would have come across it if I didn't have this random lunch with this guy.
You're talking about going on boats and to jazz shows and stuff. What are some strategies for activities, for finding activities that are a little bit counterintuitive, help you get to know a place and don't break the bank as a traveler?
My favorite search is free things to do in X. Because there's usually some free activities.
Like maybe on Google? A Google search?
Uh-huh. A Google search. Maybe there's a free walking tour. Maybe there's a bunch of parks. Maybe there's a bunch of free museums. Maybe the major museum is free one night a week, one day a week. And so I like checking that out And I like going to local tourism boards and asking them what's free or inexpensive to do. I think local tourism boards are really underappreciated because you forget that the staff there lives there and it's their job to tell you what to do in their city. And so if you go and kind of pick their brain, you can usually find some off the beaten path things to do, you know, maybe free art installations. Maybe there's like a bunch of galleries that you can go to for free. Maybe there's a festival going on that you didn't know about. And so definitely utilize them. And then, you know, if you're going to go sightsee in any major city and you're going to see a lot of museums or a lot of attractions or maybe take some tours, most major cities in the world offer it, like a city museum pass that for one price gives you free entry into pretty much anything in the city. So, and they often come with free public transportation too. You know, they're good for like 48 hours, 24, 48 or 72 hours. And so check for those. And, you know, if all the things you're going to see or most of them are there, they're probably going to save you some money.
If a young person came up to you and said they wanted to get into this long-term travel thing, what part of the world would you steer them toward in this day and age?
For like a first trip?
Yeah.
I think you can't go wrong with Southeast Asia. I think that's a good entry point. It's very affordable. There's tons of travelers there. There's like the whole system to get move you around the area. It's a fine, well-oiled machine. Food's great, climate's great, people are super friendly. There's lots to do there. You know, so like, if you've never traveled before, you might have like sensory overload. But I mean, it's such a common place to travel around. You're like, you're definitely going to see and meet lots of people. So I think that's a great area. Or if you just want to start off with something a little bit more Western familiar, Europe, Australia, New Zealand. I mean, but I think I go with Southeast Asia.
We were talking before the interview that you don't really cover the Caribbean in your book, unless you don't cover Africa either. Are there reasons why you don't have those in your $75 a day book?
Yeah, I mean, there's two reasons for it. First, I tried mostly to cover regions that your typical long-term traveler goes to. And so I'm thinking about the route, you know, your average route around the world. And a lot of people just don't go to the Caribbean because it's kind of expensive. Same with the South Pacific is not in the book. Neither are the stands. So, you know, thinking about that route. And then other, you know, Africa is such a huge continent filled with a lot of countries and a lot of cultural diversity, geographic diversity, and just like cost differences that would just be like a 500-page book on its own. And it's just, it would be really hard to make generalized statements, right? Like Western Europe, traveling around Western Europe is pretty similar. Traveling around Eastern Europe is pretty similar. Traveling around, you know, Southeast Asia, pretty similar. Traveling around Central America, pretty similar. Africa, not similar. What you do in one area is way different than another area. So it just would take a whole nother book.
In terms of thinking of a long-term journey, do you recommend and do you still use packing lists? I remember in my early travel days, that was part of the fun of traveling planning a journey was figuring out what I would bring. And eventually I kind of outgrew them. I sort of became more intuitive. What role has packing lists played in your life and do you still use them?
Yeah, I still create a packing list. You know, obviously after so many years packing for trips, I have one in my head. I kind of default to what to bring. But for example, tomorrow, Going to the Caribbean, speaking of the devil. And so, you know, tonight before I have to start packing, I will take a note on my phone and just write down everything I need just to like make sure like I'm not going to forget anything. And I just click the checklist. But like, I don't really need to do that. That's just to make sure like for my own sanity, anxiety that like, okay, like, did I pack that? Yes, it's crossed off. Did I pack that? Yes, it's crossed off. So I like to do that just for myself. I just think it makes it more efficient.
Your book, you say in your book that the $75 a day budget is very specific. How did you end up at that figure in particular, $75 a day?
Well, you know, the first book was called How to Travel the World on $50 a Day. And that was based off how much money I spent. So it's basically the same thing, just adjusted for inflation. You know, and it is a number that, you know, takes into account that you'll go to expensive countries and cheaper countries. And so, you know, obviously, if you only stick to Western Europe, that's going to be a higher number. If you only go to Australia, that's going to be a higher number. But conversely, if you stick to India or Southeast Asia or Central America, that's going to be a lower number. So it really kind of just depends where you go. Again, it's an average. But the tips in the book are really just about, like we've talked about, the strategies to finding deals and saving money and meeting locals and getting off the beaten path. You know, whether you're going to Paris for 2 weeks or 2 months, like what you do to find a cheap flight to get there is the same thing. It doesn't change.
What can you leave us with, Matt? This is sort of a sequel to your first book. And so people who might be checking out your book to sort of start dreaming their next journey, what kind of last observation or advice might you have for them?
The world is constantly changing, and travel is a great way to get a sense of like what other people are doing and how they're living in this like ever evolving time we live in. But mostly, like, you're going to meet a lot of great people, and you're going to learn a lot about yourself. And you will come out the other side of this a better, stronger, more confident, sure person. And this will be one of your like defining life things.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Matt's book, How to Travel the World on $75 a Day, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you tune in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.